My name is Morris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
All right, our speaker tonight is one of my sponsees, and I came to know this young man when I was carrying meetings out to the Ranch Treatment Center. What I'd say about this young man, he is diligent about doing the work. He wanted recovery, and he chose me. I don't know why, but he chose me. But anyway, he's done a magnificent job, and he continues to do the work and goes to meetings, and I'm not going to take up all of his time, so I'm going to introduce y'all to Joseph I.
Good evening. My name is Joseph, and I am an alcoholic. I'd just like to first off thank the Donaldson Yet Group for asking me to come out and speak. It's really a pleasure and an honor. I've been coming to this meeting since I first came to Tennessee. I just want to forewarn you that drugs are a part of my story. I'm not only an alcoholic, but I am a drug addict. I've done everything that you can think of, from drinking to doing the most excessive things that relate to illegal substances. I came from a really good family home that was really revolved around, you know, community and growing up in a healthy environment. I come from a big Italian household, and my parents were both very loving people. They really drove into me that, you know, respect is big, you know, be joyous, be happy. And that evolved into a lot of my life and how I articulated myself from that point on. But the dynamic was a lot different than I had realized from the beginning. My father was a very controlling man, and my mother quite the enabler, and that drove different parts of my story, as I'll elaborate on. I came from a home where I had an older brother and a younger sister, both very academically acclaimed. One was a sports star, another was a high-class student, and I was just in the middle as the sheep. And that brought about a lot for me in insecurity and inadequacy, but that revolves around this first event that happened in my life. When I was 10 years old, I had a situation happen to me that traumatized me so deeply that I couldn't function as a human being anymore. I didn't know what it was to be a child or to be an adult. At the age of 10, I had to change my whole entire viewpoint on life as it stood in front of me. The thing about that situation that drove me into this differing ideology of not trusting anyone and continuing to push everything inside of myself was that I chose to tell a friend of mine about this situation, and they decided to take this information that I tried to share with them to bear my burden for someone to see me, for someone to feel me, for someone to know who I was, this insecure kid who was so lost. And this person decided to take this information and spread it across my whole entire school. So from that point on, I was labeled as something that I didn't even identify with, and I didn't know myself. So this concept was brought up into my life that I couldn't trust anyone. I couldn't trust an adult. I couldn't trust my friends. I couldn't trust the people around me. And it bred a very deep insecurity that I got lost in, actually, for a really long time. And I made sure that I always kept you at arm's length. You didn't know where I lived. You didn't know how my family revolved. You didn't know anything about me, really. You just knew my name, and that's all you knew. And you knew the actions that I took. From that point on, I had a very deep part of me that was broken, and I decided to articulate that in a lot of different ways, whether that was acting out as a young kid in school, you know, excessively propelling myself to sports and trying to academically achieve as high as I could. But what it was for me was really a mission to seek out an escape. I'm an escapist. That's what I am. Besides being an alcoholic, I am a bone and bred escapist. And at age 13, I found the solution to that. You know, you wouldn't think that a kid would be able to find that at 13 or what he thought was the solution, but I did, because my family was very big. You know, we'd have parties, there'd be hundreds of people, and they'd all be drinking, and it'd be hoorah and hooray, and everyone's laughing and joking. So alcohol to me was but a thing, you know. Everyone did it. I have no problem with that. You know, none of these people in my family have a problem with this, so it shouldn't be a bad idea. And the funny thing about that is my family, you know, coming from an Italian household, we used to have three refrigerators and one all the way out in the backyard that was always stocked with beer. So me being a young kid and wanting to be the cool kid because I wanted to fit in really bad, I went into that fridge because it was always stocked and I filled my backpack with Heinekens. And I remember riding my bike over to my friend's house that first time I got drunk, and I could hear the bottles clink in my backpack. And I vividly remember that, you know, I'm the coolest kid in town. I got the beer in my bag. I'm going to show up. And I just thought I was, like, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. That's just what I was. And, you know, that first sip of the beer, I hated it. I hated it. But once I got to that third one, the room was spinning, I was feeling good, the laughs were going, and I saw the appeal. Not because of the way it made me feel, but because it made me forget who I was, just for a moment. And that first night, I'm ending up hanging out my friend's window, puking two stories down into his backyard, and his parents are wondering what's going on, and, you know, I'm thinking I'm living the high life. And I continue to perpetuate this process. And, you know, drinking is on the weekends. And I'm stealing, you know, doing the mixed liquors from my parents' liquor cabinet. And they're not going to notice, because if I mix some water with the liquor, they'll never be able to tell. Because I'm a genius, you know, a real sophisticated alcoholic. From 10 to 16, I continue to evolve myself into these groups of more broken people. Because, like, if you're more broken than me, then I'm better than you, and I feel that. And that was a really deep ego thing for me that related to a lot in my life. You know, everything I did was based off of something that I thought you had that was better than me, and I had to top that. So I continued to function into group after group and friend after friend. You know, I wanted to be friends with everybody because I just wanted someone to understand me. That's all I begged for my whole entire life. And you know, I couldn't talk to my parents because they were always fighting, and I had to try and fix that situation. I'm trying to rescue this person, and I got the more broken friend whose family's all messed up, and I'm having him come to my house. And I continue to become Superman for everyone else but myself. And that only drains me at the end of the day. So, you know, I find my first love. Your alcoholic first love. The girl that can drink with you. The girl that, you know, will smoke weed with you on the weekends. And she likes to dabble in a couple other things that you haven't tried yet. And I found this girl and I thought that I had found the answer. You know, I thought affection was going to save me. The things I couldn't get from my parents, even though they were extremely loving, the thing that I couldn't get from my parents was this piece of love that I thought I was missing. You know, that void I was trying to fill. My whole entire life was going to be solved by this individual. But in this whole concept, I learned that I am the most people-pleasing person you can find. I'm seeking so much approval from this person. I just want them to validate my existence. And I end up violating myself and demoralizing myself in this situation because I'm running from everything that's outside and bringing it into this relationship. And that creates a huge field of anger in my life that I can't express. You know, I'm going into this relationship and, you know, leave me alone, don't talk to me, you know. This girl just wants affection and I'm telling her to get away from me. And I realize after a while, like, I'm not even happy with this person. They're just in my life because I'm alone and I just want someone to be there. My whole entire existence up to now is based on this relationship, based on the, you know, money that I can have, based on proving to my friends that I'm the best fighter and standing up for other people. So I came out with the bold face. You believed that I was the bold face. And you believed that you could come to me and tell me all your problems. And that was just another way for me to run from my own. You come to me and I'm the vault for you to tell me your truth, while I'm hiding everything that's inside of me and I'm just putting on a smile every single day. So this relationship continues to escalate and stuff, and the fighting gets more violent, and it's just screaming match after screaming match, and her crying and telling me not to leave and me just telling her to leave me alone. I don't want to be alone, but I really just want to be alone. And this situation turned very bad one night. We were driving to her house, and I had procured some substance for her father, and you know, I'm driving this over to her dad's house and stuff, and we're arguing about her sleeping over, and I do a fast maneuver into a parking lot, and the next thing I know, I got flashing lights behind me, and I'm like, oh man, here we go. I had never interacted with the police yet, and you know, in my area growing up, Suffolk County, this is the highest paid police force in America, so they do what they want to you. And I have a really soft spot for women because of what I've seen women exposed to in my life, you know, the submission, the defamation, and that cultivated into that exact situation. This police officer was taking me out of the car and handcuffing me, and the other older gentleman was ripping my girlfriend out of the car, and I couldn't watch that. I really couldn't. You know, it struck a serious chord with me, and I said to the officer, I said, what are you doing? You know, why are you ripping her out of the car right now? I'm the one that you're arresting. She has nothing to do with this. And the police officer behind me decided that it was correct to slam my head against the top of my car. And the next thing I know, within a flash of a second, all I hear is 5'10 resisting arrest. And my instinct in my head is, you gotta run. You really gotta run. This is gonna go bad real quick. And this man nicked my shirt and threw me on the ground. And more police officers than I've ever seen show up to any crime scene in my whole entire life showed up at that scene. And they decided that it was time for me to become the punching bag. After this point in time, I'm screaming, bleeding all over the ground. You know, I'm begging for help. And I think that EMS has showed up to save me because they've beat me so bad at this point. But it's not EMS, it's SWAT for a 17-year-old kid and his girlfriend. I'm watching these officers while I'm pinned to the ground hitting my girlfriend. I can remember the screams of her watching this. And I had to go to a family barbecue after that next day after I got out of jail. And my wrists were so bruised from the handcuffs that I'd wear a long sleeve shirt in the middle of the summer. I had now become labeled as a criminal. I had police officers harass me from this point on, saying that if I ever laid a hand on a police officer, I'd find out what it was like to really be beaten. So this drives me to really, really resent authority, resent anyone that's above me, resent anyone that I thought could harm me. And the protection wall had been pretty big at that point already, but I brought it up tenfold after that. And, you know, this is the first time. I'm a 17-year-old kid. I get a DUI. I get harassment in the second degree. And none of these charges are dropped on top of the other 15 that I got because it's not justified. The bruises, the cuts, the holes in my legs from them hitting me with nightsticks, it's not justified. So I'm set off in this path, and does this deter me from doing what I wanted to do? Do I learn a lesson from this? No, never that. Never that. I'm deciding that trafficking drugs and stuff is a good idea while on probation and with a conditional license, you know, getting pulled over constantly. Real genius ideas. And I thought that at this time, you know, that I didn't have a problem. Like, you know, if you did heroin or you did, you know, these other drugs, that, like, you were way worse than I was, and that I was better than you because I could go out and get beer for my friends and go to a party and, like, do a lot more drugs than you could and drink more than you could. So I was the cooler kid. And I built this conscious idea in my head that I had sold myself, that if I was just a little bit further along than you, I could live a little bit better. You would see me more. And that was my way for people to see me, because I couldn't actually tell you about my emotions and feelings. I didn't even know how to describe them, let alone come into a conversation and tell you, you know, I love you and I just really feel sad right now. No, I had a solution for that. I figured out my solution to that. So, you know, it comes around that I'm, you know, just continuing to progress, and I'm trying other things, and I'm, you know, getting into, you know, falling asleep at my house in the driveway, and my parents are worried about my safety at this point, so I go to rehab because that's going to solve all the problems. You know, I'm going to go to rehab and I'm going to learn all about drug addiction and alcoholism, and I'm going to be cured. I'm going to come home, I'll be able to drink like a gentleman. You know, that's it. And, you know, a 19-year-old kid is really receptive to going into upstate New York in the middle of nowhere in the winter. Loved it. Really great. So, you know, I go to this treatment center, I learn all this stuff about alcoholism and addiction, and, you know, I come out of it, I'm AA captain. You know, I'm going to come out and I'm going to go to AA in New York, and I got all the answers, I'm going to get a sponsor. And when I tell you I was the best liar I've ever seen in my whole entire life, the best self-negotiator I've ever seen in my whole entire life, I did it for myself. You know, but I really did everything that I was doing just to please the people around me, like just to shut them up for a little bit. If the peanut gallery would just be quiet, I can fix myself in due time. And that didn't stop me. It never stopped me. No idea, nothing you told me would help me would ever stop me from doing what I wanted, because in myself, I don't care about you. I never cared about you. I didn't care about my parents, you know, girlfriend, whatever, my dog I didn't even care about, so why am I gonna care about anyone else? And I decided that I would continue to use a more dangerous thing, and it ended up having some serious medical ramifications, and I was withdrawing one night, and it was my birthday, my 19th birthday, and my father and mother would not let me leave the house. It's my birthday. I'm entitled to go out on my birthday. I'm entitled to do what I want on my birthday. And they were done. They were really at wit's end with me. And, you know, this ends up turning into me being cornered in my bedroom. And I'm an animal at this point. I'm not domesticated in any form. So when you trap me in a corner, I'm going to react. And that's all I knew how to do. So I started brawling my household on my birthday with my father and my older brother, who are two times my size. And, you know, I just pushed them out of my way. I just want to leave. You know, I'm trapped in this idea that I just want to leave and I can't get out of it. And my father and I are like tussling around. He's lifting me off the ground with one arm, choking me. And I'm just, all I want to do is just leave. Just let me go. This will all end if you just let me leave. And I remember getting in such a tussle at one point that I found my mother and my sister curled up in a ball together at the top of the staircase. And when they looked at me at that moment, it was like I was a stranger in my own household, a monster in front of them. So, you know, my father being the man he is and me being the man that I am and what he has taught me, we go out front and we're going to solve this situation. And he keeps telling me, if I'm a tough guy, I'll just hit him. I'll just hit him. In that split second, I pumped every bit of anger that I had ever had for another human being into one single punch. This man sits back, and that egotistical insanity in my head's like, yeah, you did it. You set him down. You finally made him be quiet. And then the screams come. And the ambulances show up. And I almost took my father's eye from hitting him. This man is in the hospital wondering if he's going to lose his eye, and the cops are begging him to charge me with felony assault. And he's telling them to screw off. You know, and I think that the solution to this situation is to shut my phone off while detectives from my town are calling me. And what do? I go get high, because that's what I know how to do. I don't return to my household for 2 months. My parents don't know where I am. No one knows where I am. And the regret that I had around that situation was something that I still deal with today because of what I exposed my family to, what I know I can do. And you know, I really thought that if I just could, you know, end it, if I could just slow it down a little bit, if I could just stop this whole process in my head, that I would solve it all. And I found out that that is not how it works. Not in God's world. I decided that I was going to overdose after, you know, a couple of months after my birthday, and I had to go to work the next morning. So I take an absorbent amount of drugs, and most people would die from the amount that I was taking, and I thought it would kill me, but it didn't. So I wake up frantic, stumbling up my stairs, and my mother is watching me take the keys from her hand and walk out the door crying. And you know what I'm telling her? I need to go to work because I need to get paid. Not because I need to make money and show up for work, but because I need to get what I want. I get behind the wheel of that car and I don't remember a single thing from it. Not a single thing. I pull up in my front of the guy who I was working for his house, and I get out and there's blood all over the front of the car. And I'm thinking, oh, I must have hit somebody's dog. I'll just drive the car home and I'll get my mom to drive me back to work. I pull up to the house and my mother is sitting on the front porch bawling, crying. Because at this point, I didn't know that it was the imprint of someone's skull in the front windshield. And, you know, I get arrested that day. And the detective comes into me and he stares in my face and he says to me, he says, "Do I need to drug test you right now?" I said, "No, sir. I've never seen somebody smile in my face like that in my whole entire life. Not once." I was at a point in time where I didn't think there was anything left, and I'm in my house every day, you know, crying because I don't know what's going to happen at this point. I get news the next couple of days after I get released that the man that I had hit is now in a coma, and they don't know if he's going to wake up. They don't know if he's going to die. They don't have any answers at this point, and I'm sitting in my room every day just like this, you know, rocking back and forth like this, you know, wondering, is this man going to die yet? Am I going to lose the rest of my teenage years to sitting in prison? Am I going to never come home? Am I going to change into something I never thought I would be? And I'm sitting in the bathroom crying one day, and my father comes in here and he says, "It's all going to be all right. The man that I had disrespected my whole entire life is telling me that it's all going to be all right." And a family friend of ours that didn't really know me but knew me from when I was growing up, he made a phone call for me that changed my whole entire existence. He made a phone call that had ramifications where I would just get probation. 75 people mailed letters to my house after seeing me on the news of character reference. And I tried to look at them one day, and I couldn't read past the first line of the first letter because I didn't believe a single word that was on that paper. You know, I get probation. I think that, you know, I'm going to do the right thing now. I've really messed it up at this point. You know, my family is destroyed from this. My people are reaching out to all the contacts in their whole entire life to make sure that I come home. And I become the model probationee because that's what I know how to do. I know how to be a perfectionist. And, you know, if you saw me on paper, I was showed up to court every day. You know, I always had a clean drug test. I never gave them any problems. The POs didn't even have to come in my house because I was so good. But at this time, I decided that I was going to be the worst dry human being I could. So I cultivated every negative aspect of my character in the worst ways. The violence escalates. The, you know, the way I treat women escalates. The, you know, relationship manipulation escalates. Everything, just every character defect you can possibly ever imagine, I just shoot it to the stars. Because I have nothing to solve those problems now, and I don't know what's going on. So, me being this model probationee, I get this great job, you know, I'm making more money than a 40-year-old man, and, you know, all these people around me, I got the nicest new car, and I don't think this is enough, because I don't have enough problems as it is. I decide that trafficking a lot of illegal substance is a great idea at this point. You know, I'm not talking about where I would just do it willy-nilly, I'm talking about I should be in prison for 25 years because I was driving around with what could kill somebody as well as what could kill me. And it still wasn't enough. I was making 40 grand a year on the books and 20 grand a week, and it still wasn't enough. I still didn't think it was enough. So, solution again. You know, another solution, because I'm the mastermind of solution. I find myself getting in another relationship because that's going to solve it again. You know, my appeal looks good to a girl because I got money and a nice car and this, that, and the other thing. And that's all I cared about is how you saw me. So I get in this relationship and, you know, I think everything's going to be grand. This is the perfect girl for me again. You know, she's going to do it. And she cheats on me in the first month that we're together. But I'm this sober individual who's, you know, very fit in everything that I do emotionally. And I forgive her. And my only response to her was, if you're going to do drugs, you can do them with me. Probably the stupidest thing I've ever said in my whole entire life. Because from that point, when I agreed to that idea, to the minute that I arrived in the ranch in Tennessee, was the worst years of my life. I get off of probation and stuff, and, you know, everything's working out, I'm doing good, and, you know, I have this great alcoholic idea that I'm just going to smoke weed on the weekends, because I can do that. You know, I didn't, you know, go to rehab already and almost go to prison for the existence of my life because I did a bunch of excessive drugs. You know, I'm good. I can smoke weed on the weekends. The conviction is really great with me when I'm doing my thing. And I took that opportunity to do that, and it was never satisfying enough. So the escalation grows, and I decide that, you know, using opioids is going to be a good way to solve my problems, because the feeling that I got from that was the ultimate escape, the in-between point of being dead and kind of living on the edge. So everything in my life continues to spiral pretty badly at this point, and I don't need to really go into detail about that because it gets really bad. And there's only one analogy that I can truly relate to that. If you look at the bottom of a deep ocean abyss, it is the darkest place in the world, hands down. But in that space, there's so much pressure that it is crushing you, that it is truly strangling your soul. And that's what I was doing. I wasn't only just destroying myself by the amount of pressure that I was putting on me, but I was crushing everything that I was into this microscopic ball that had no light left. And the depth of that was something I never thought I would experience. You know, I never thought I would be the guy who was begging someone for food, the guy that was living in a tent, the guy that would have to rob his parents to get money. And I became all of those things and more. Not only did I find out that I could become those things, but I found out how deep that hole can get, you know, because people talk about bottoms. I'll talk about bottoms, but like, I dug to the bottom, and then I dug through the bottom, and then I went through the steel plate, and I was trying to get to the center of the earth, because that was my goal. It was either kill myself from what I was doing, or live as long as I could doing it. And that was it. You know, so at this point, I think that it's a good idea. You know, I'm going to seek solution. And, you know, my aunt had been an addict as well, and she had found some type of solution. So I think I'm going to go to her to find the solution. But this whole time, I'm in my head knowing that Alcoholics Anonymous is the only solution that I can find, and I know it works. But I'm convincing myself that she can taper me off, and I'll get clean, and I'll live a fruitful life from there. But that's not the case. I discovered that heroin addiction and what else I was using was the only solution. And I would put that over everything in my whole entire existence. Hands down. Without a question. My aunt came into my room on Christmas one night and gave me money because she knew how sick I was. Because she knew how bad off I was. I couldn't even go to a family event and stand with my family while there's 50 people upstairs. I was in my room because I couldn't be there. I hadn't been present since the age of 10. What makes you think I'm going to be here at 22? She comes into my room that same night and she said to me, she said, you know, you have two choices at this point. You can go to rehab or you can become homeless again. And I said to myself, I said, convincingly enough, I say to myself, you know, give me till Monday. Just pay for me to get high until Monday and I'll go wherever you want me to go. And, you know, that's the great conviction of, you know, my disease. And I convinced my family to do that and allow me to do that. And it's not that my parents could convince me. It's not that my sister's tears could convince me. It's not all the nights that my brother came and checked on me that could convince me. It's my aunt telling me that I have nothing left. And her knowing actually what it looks like. So, do I want to go to treatment in Tennessee in the middle of nowhere? Absolutely not. I'm a city boy. I don't like the trees. I don't like whatever you guys got out here. That's not my goal. And I really didn't want to go. I really didn't. You know, I'm on the plane like, damn, I should have, you know, did a lot more before I got on this plane. This is a terrible idea. What am I doing right now? I'm in the middle of LaGuardia Airport trying to walk out and, you know, go into the city. What kind of insanity? And I'm on this plane and I'm just crushed. I am absolutely crushed. I had looked at my life for a minute in that flight and it was destroyed. I had torched everything that I had ever loved, and my heart in turn became torched. When I got to the ranch, you know, I made a pact with myself on that first day. These journals that are sitting right here, I wrote in that first journal, and the journal entry was about, like, getting my credit fixed and, you know, getting sober and, you know, fixing my family because I'm that crazy. You know, fixing my credit score is going to keep me sober, so... Let's just all know that now. I'm 20 grand in debt at this point, though, so don't worry about that. So, you know, at the ranch, I make this pact on that first page, though, that I'm going to be as honest as I possibly can with myself. You know, honest to the point where I'm going to lay it all out. Everything. Every whatever it was. So I got to tell somebody. I haven't been able to tell anybody my whole entire life. I need to tell somebody. And I really dropped my guard, and I really let myself be just where I was instead of everywhere else. And that was the answer for me, to really connect with myself internally. And the first time that AA was brought into the ranch, you know, I heard this man speaking, and I saw who he was, and I, you know, I saw the reformation in him, and I just identified with a lot of what he was saying, but mostly the thick-headedness. Like, that was it for me, because that's me to the T. And, you know, I sat and I listened for a couple weeks. You know, I sat and listened for a couple weeks, and I finally was like, you know, they keep telling me to get a sponsor, so I should probably get one. So I go to his home group meeting, and I tell some lady, random lady, that I'm going to ask him. I'm nervous to ask him. And she says, you should just grow a pair of balls then. I said, all right, I guess that's God's answer then, so we're going to take it from there. And I went up to this man and I asked him to be my sponsor, and I honestly didn't think he was going to say yes. I really didn't. You know, I'm some podunk kid from New York, and he did. And it wasn't, the reason why I asked him to be my sponsor is not because I saw what he had and I wanted it, but because I knew that we were so different that I could learn something from him, and that's what I needed. But what he showed me was how to be an adult, how to be a man, how to be a human being, really. And that was all I could ever ask for, because I didn't know how to do that. You know, I truly believe that before I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, myself personally, I am an undomesticated animal, a wild animal. But when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I take those simple suggestions for a moment, and reach out to someone else and tell them this thing that's going on in my skull, that I become a little more domesticated. There's a little bit of a fence around me, and there's a little bit of protection around me from this thing that's outside of me. For a long time, my whole entire world was upside down. Whatever you thought was the light of the city was the darkness of hell, and that's all I knew. You know, so I finally asked this man to be my sponsor, and I come out of treatment, and I go to sober living because, like, I'm doing whatever you guys say at this point because I don't know what to do. And I stay in sober living for 6 months, and I get a lot out of that. You know, I get connected with AA. I go to a lot of meetings with my sponsor because I don't have a car. I get a job. You know, I'm doing all these things. I opened a bank account, guys. I don't even know what that looks like, really, because my mattress was the best one I ever had. And I finally learned that there's people that unconditionally love you, you know, really unconditionally love you. And I felt that. I felt that for the first time in my life that I actually had found home, you know, because my whole entire life I was truly homeless, you know, not particularly not sheltered, but homeless. And when I felt what AA could give me in unconditional love, I had never known anything so peaceful in my life. And you know, I made an effort to do whatever anyone asked of me in here. If it meant taking out the garbage, if it meant, you know, talking 15 minutes after the meeting, if it meant going out to lunch with someone when I didn't want to, if it meant doing whatever you told me. If you told me to lick the dirt, I would have done it. Because that's how desperate I was. And, you know, I found that there's a point between desperation and despair where fortune shines down upon you. And, like, that's where I was. So I'm going to take this effort, and I'm going to move along with it. And, you know, in my first 4 months of sobriety, I was facing a year in prison for a bunch of, a slew of other charges I had gotten because, you know, stealing cheese and bread from supermarkets is a good idea, especially when you're, like, shoving it down your pants in the middle of the aisle. Real genius stuff. And I was going to court, and I brought my sponsor with me at that time. And he sat in the courtroom with me, and he listened to my charges, and he saw me going up there, and this man who was my lawyer only had met me twice, but he knew my cousin who fought my original case, almost killing that guy, and he put his name on the line for me. The judge looked at me, and he said, "You should be doing a year in prison right now," and I said, nothing, because I didn't know what to say, and he gave me $400 in fines. And my sponsor walked out of that courtroom with me, and he told me, he said, "You can either make that man look like a fool, or you can be who he believes you are." And I've never felt someone's words in that sense in my whole entire life. Because that's who I wanted to be, that person that was standing in front of that judge as a citizen, as someone who cared about other people, who I really was, that authentic person. And we went home that night and had dinner with my family. And my father is not an emotionally connected man. This man sat down at the dinner table with us, and he told me that every day of my addiction that he thought he was going to bury me, he was waiting to bury me. To hear that from your parents is not only the hardest thing to hear, but the most awakening. And this man was crying over this situation. And I never thought in my whole entire life this man loved me. And in that moment, I knew that everything he tried to do was because he loved me. You know, this is... been the most amazing time of my whole entire life, hands down. I've seen things that I had never seen in my whole entire life. I've experienced things that I've never experienced in my whole entire life, and I have a community of people that when I tell you would show up to my house if I didn't answer my phone, they do. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, and you know, more than I could ever have imagined. My parents are in town today to celebrate a year of sobriety with me. I didn't think that I could get 5 days sober, let alone a year. And the only solution that I know today is this. The only solution that I know today is listening to a suggestion. But ultimately, I know that what I have gotten is not something that is given freely.
It is because I am so willing to never live that exact moment when I got on that flight ever again in my life. Because I am so committed, not only because I want to say, yes, I'll do it and I'll get sober, but because on the worst day of my life, if I stay committed, I can get through anything. I almost lost my fingers in sobriety. I've gone through unbelievable highs and unbelievable lows, and I'm still sober. And, you know, it doesn't make sense to me some days. I got a year sober, and I honestly couldn't tell you what I was feeling that day. It just felt like another day. But you know what I knew is that there is a specific reason that I am here, and that I am a living, breathing miracle. And I don't just say that about myself. I say that about any alcoholic that comes in here and survives, because that's the truth. You know, I went into the kitchen of my brother's house after I had injured myself, and I made a joke to him about getting a job. And he works for Dell, and this man shot an email off, and I had an interview the next day. I now work for Dell. Dell wouldn't hire me if I was the person I was. Dell wouldn't talk to me. You wouldn't talk to me if I was the person that I was. And today I'm not. I'm just Joseph Iorio, and that's it. I am an alcoholic, and I'm just glad to be an alcoholic. I'm proud to be an alcoholic. Did I ever tell you, you know, in my life that I would say that? No. I could have never told you that. But today I would scream it from the rooftops, because that's what I am, and I know what I am. I've been able to connect more dots about my story and about my life and find compassion for people that I never thought I would find, and forgiveness and so many other avenues of my life from this program and from what my sponsor has given me, from the outside help that I have gotten. And that is the true gift. I know that there's something that's bigger than me out here, whether I call that God or the universe or the dirt under my shoes. I know that it's taking care of me, and that there's nothing that I can do today except believe in that. So my faith has grown over time, and I just want to make sure that I continue to believe that, because my whole entire life was based off resentment, and I've changed that concept, because I can change whatever I believe. And I believe that I love myself today, and that I'm proud to be an alcoholic. So thank you for listening. Thank you.